nevertheless. So this afternoon we return once again to the close application of mindfulness to the body. And I'd like to spend a short time, again, providing a little bit more theory to inform, to enrich, to illuminate our actual empirical investigations. To my mind, one of the terrific success stories of modern science over the last 400 years, going right back to the time of Galileo and even before then to Copernicus, is this ongoing dynamic between theoretical physics and experimental physics. Now, during the time of Galileo, you were both, although Kepler, for example, was only a theoretician. He wasn't an experimentalist. Copernicus was only a theoretician, not experimentalist, but Galileo was the whole package. Newton was the whole package, great experimentalist and a great theoretician. But as we move on into the 19th century, 20th century, then you pretty much fall into one of the two camps, although people like Anton Zeilinger, who's an experimentalist, also is very well versed in theory. But my point here is a simple one, and that is there are people like Einstein. I don't know if he ever ran an experiment in his life. I doubt it. His research laboratory was his blackboard, or just pencil and paper. So coming up with these, and Max Planck was the same, coming up with these theoretical ideas that wouldn't be then just simply debated and debated and debated among other theoretical physicists and just with more and more theory, but actually the whole idea of the theory, at its best, and it often was at its best, was here's a theory, okay, you experimentalist, try this on for size. Can you put that to the test of experiment, right? And then they would come up with new empirical investigations or discoveries, and that would enrich the theory, and then the theory would go back and enrich the experiment, and so back and forth, it was really just a fantastic combination, quite spectacular. And that's exactly what we don't have for the scientific study of the mind. We have people studying behavior, we have people studying brain. Where are the great theoreticians? I don't think there are any. I think the neuroscientists, they've really been coming up with one experiment after another. But who's standing back? Well, you have the philosophers of mind, but they're not coming up with any experiments. So they're sitting on the lines debating among themselves while most people ignore them. And so it's kind of lost touch. They've drifted off by themselves, and the experimentalists are sludging around in 19th century physics with a dearth of really fresh ideas. I mean, that's my judgment, but it is my judgment. I stand by it. So in Buddhism, that happens too. It happens frequently that people who are really brilliant in the debating and the analysis and the writing and the theory and so forth hardly do any meditation, and then you get people who are really gung-ho in meditation, doing dhummo and so forth, hardly have a clue about the theory. So it easily gets separated there as well. But that's not Buddhism at its best. And there is such a thing as Buddhism at its best, and that is people like Chandrakirti and Shantideva and Tsongkhapa and so forth and so on. You find, whoa, like Galileo, they were great experimentalists, and they were yogis, and they were brilliant when it came to theory. And people like, and when they come up with the theories, then of course the theories are for the sake of putting it to the test of experiment or experience, back to your research, to meditation. So in that spirit, really trying to revitalize, and that's exactly what His Holiness was talking to me about 1 week ago, revitalizing. The whole spirit of shamatha vipassana, not only in Buddhism, but across the boards, among all the contemplative traditions that have something like shamatha vipassana, to revitalize, breathe fresh, fresh life into it. Because as he told me just last Wednesday, he said, well, we have it. I mean, there are Tibetan yogis here and there really practicing shamatha and vipassana, but they're rare. And most of them are doing they're doing dhummo, they're doing six yoga naropa, they're doing lamrim, they're doing vajrasattva. They're doing 3 retreats and so forth and so on. And hello, is anybody doing shamatha? Almost nobody. Is anybody really doing vipassana with the power, the muscle of shamatha behind it? Well, almost nobody, but that doesn't mean nobody. So if anybody on the planet can find really accomplished Tibetan yogis who are really deeply experienced in shamatha vipassana, he's the man. And he's going to be the recruiting force to cherry pick some of these people and bring them down to Bangalore when ready. That'll be very cool. And he's going to the Kumela, the great Hindu gathering, I think, next January, and keep his eyes open for those yogis from the Himalayas, the swamis, and see if he can persuade some of them. Want to come to Bangalore? As he was saying to me, in old times, the old tradition was off in your caves. And so they've disappeared. They're low profile. Nobody knows about them. But he said, now in the 21st century, we need to have it a bit more in an institution. So please come from out of your compassion, come from your cave, come down to Bangalore, and help these younger aspirants who would really like to learn from your experience. Yeah. So a bit of theory, but now theory not in terms of just something to think about, theory as in the same of in the sense of teoria, the term I mentioned yesterday from Greek, which means to behold, to look. Darshana, same. Dawa in Tibetan, same. So theory, talking, concepts, intended to enrich your way of viewing, investigating, probing into experience self, like the dynamic between theoretical physics and experimental physics. So I'll just draw out one theme for this afternoon, and it's a really powerful one. It has a lot of just tremendous application in daily life, and it's a very simple point. Some of you have studied Buddhist philosophy, you already know it, but I'll bet you never had any chance to practice it, because often it's just taught by itself. Buddhist theory of causality. We're right back to classical physics. I mean classical Buddhism. Sautrantika. Just classical. You learn this, you know, you learn this when you're in kindergarten, when in the first year as a Buddhist monk or nun. Now we get some nuns, Tibetan and one Westerner now, Geshe, right? So they've been through all of this. Well, you get this in first grade. But saying it's in first grade doesn't mean it's silly or stupid or primitive. It just means it's foundational. Buddhist notion of causality, here it is in a nutshell, okay? And that is, so we're dealing with real phenomena. Real phenomena are those that you can perceive, that have causal efficacy. Everything you perceive, or that is perceivable, has causal efficacy, which means it arises independent upon causes and conditions, and everything that is a fruit, a result, is itself a cause. So there's no unmoved mover, there's no cause that doesn't have a preceding cause. There's no cause that does not have its own effects. There's no effects that don't have their own effects. And so it's all within a network, a web of causality, right? So that's just for starters. All right. But now within this network of causality, two types of causes. So I'll call them substantial cause and cooperative condition. Don't get too heavy about the notion of substantial. It's just that the substance is just the stuff of which the phenomenon in question is made. So let's take a nice easy example. It's the classic example. And that is, let's say you have a little grain of wheat. A little grain of wheat. Okay? So there it is. Now that arose independent upon causes and conditions. There's something that transformed into that grain of wheat. But that's what you have in your hand right now. Grain of wheat. You put it in the soil. And then you fertilize it. You mulch it. Add a little bit of water. Let some sunlight come to it. And then what happens? The stuff inside the husk, so the juice inside the grain of wheat, as it germinates, then it sends a little tendril down, it's a little taproot, and it sends a little shoot up, the first shoot of the wheat stalk, and the stuff inside the wheat kernel, that is the husk, inside actually gets transformed and used up, gets used up and transforms into the taproot going down and the shoot going up. So by the time it's really growing, then that husk is empty. There's no more seed inside because the stuff of the seed has turned into the root and the sprout, and there it goes, right? And so we're going to say that the seed, the wheat seed, or the little grain, is the substantial cause of the wheat, the subsequent wheat stalk, and then eventually, you know, the whole wheat sprout, right? Because it actually transformed into the stuff of the wheat stalk. And in so doing, it got used up. It lost its former identity as a seed. It no longer is a seed. The seed's gone. But the stuff of which the seed was made has transformed into the stuff of which the sprout is made. Right? Now, in the process of that, there are many cooperative conditions. And a general principle in Buddhism is that anything that arises always must arise from a substantial cause, which is to say you never get something from nothing. You can never have a lot of cooperative conditions coming in and transform nothing into something. That would be magic, and there's no magic in Buddhism. There's paranormal, but there's no magic. And so something always transformed into something, but you never have nothing transforming into something with a lot of help from its friends. Okay? So let's take just like an indisputable aspect of this. So you got that little grain of wheat, and it's within a sack full of wheat, and it's owned by a farmer. And the farmer is looking at the newspaper saying, okay, what is next year's, the cost of wheat likely to be? What are the futures? What are the prospects for the price of wheat? And he said, oh, compared to soy and barley and oats, looks like wheat's going to do really well. There's going to be a lot of demand. Over there was a drought, so the cost of wheat, okay, this year on that 40 acres, I'm not going to go for wheat, or I'm not going to go for barley, oats, or soy. It's going to be wheat next year. Now, he makes a decision based upon what he read in the newspaper, and it's a guy, so Mr. Farmer, and he says, okay, wheat it is, all right? So his decision that he's going to plant that field with wheat, that is a cooperative condition. Had he not made that decision, that wheat could just sit in the bag and then just eventually to rot and never turn into a wheat sprout. But he made the decision. Now, I think that's where the profit is. All right, that's where it's going. So there's a cooperative condition. Now, there are many others as well. He needs a tractor. He needs something to plow the soil. So there are many cooperative conditions that don't actually transform into the wheat. But without them, that seed won't transform into the wheat either. Okay? But he didn't transform into the wheat. His tractor didn't transform into the wheat. His idea or decision didn't transform into the wheat. And so, basic principle, for whatever effect there is in the universe, it never comes about as a result of one cause. Never one. One is never enough. Doesn't matter whether it's God or Buddha nature or anything else. One is never enough. It always has to be that concatenation or that confluence, that gathering together of substantial cause, and then any number of direct and indirect cooperative conditions. Like, why is the wheat? Why is the cost of wheat next year going to be high? Well, there was a drought here. That drought was a cooperative condition for this farmer planting his wheat here. And what caused the drought? Oh, well, it was global warming. What caused the global warming? Detroit. It always boils down to Detroit. So, but you can see, you can just take that chain back and back and back and back and back, and it just, you wind up with Indra's net of this vast, I mean really inconceivably vast array of direct and then indirect, going back into time, of all of the conditions that independence upon which, there's a wheat field, right? You need the substantial cause, you need the cooperative conditions, and a variety, not just one, but a variety of cooperative conditions, and then gives rise. So now, there's a general theme. Now we come here to the body, the close application of mindfulness to the body. And the Buddha in the Satipatthana Sutra, so I'm taking Satrantika view and applying this to the Satrantika, the Satipatthana Sutta, Buddha's teachings on the close application of mindfulness. It's really a marriage made in Bodhgaya. It really, they just fit so beautifully together. I mean, just savor it. It's like fine wine, you know. Because the Satrantika by itself, it doesn't naturally suggest do this practice. But as soon as you see Satipatthana, you say, oh, well, man, those should go together. Absolutely go together. So, what does the Buddha say about the close application of mindfulness to the body, referring to your own body, others' bodies, physical phenomena at large? He says now, the term translated in English is contemplate. That is, attend closely but intelligently, and don't be afraid to think once in a while. Contemplate the factors of origination. That is, you're experiencing earth element arising in your body. You're experiencing water here, you're experiencing your body here, you're experiencing movement and so forth, your own body, other people's bodies and so forth. And so what are the factors of origination? What are the substantial causes, cooperative conditions that gave rise to this effect that you're experiencing right now in the present moment? What are the factors of origination? And then he says, and then contemplate, again, attend to closely, reflect upon, observe, investigate, analyze, the factors of disillusion. Factors of disillusion. So, whatever it is, it's a sensation of earth element in your knee, or whatever it may be, they don't last. Number one, they're not static. And number two, they probably don't last forever. So, when they vanish, or when they're dissipating, when they're dissolving, what are the factors? What are the conditions giving rise to the disillusion, the vanishing of whatever you're attending to in the physical world? Because that's what the close application of mindfulness of the body is. I should quote it. I don't have it right here, but there's a great, very famous quote where the Buddha says, and I paraphrase badly, but he said, within this fathom-long body, you will find the nature of the origins, the nature of the universe. Here's the microcosm. Understand your body 100%, you get the whole picture. And really, in a way, that's not silly. Because you consider from the cosmology perspective, where did the atoms in your body coming from? Where did the energy in your body come from? It traces back to the Big Bang. Right? And so, but there it is, without pushing that too far. Nevertheless, the Buddha is saying there's a wealth of wisdom, of insight, knowledge to be gained, not only about what is enclosed within your skin, but your body is embedded in the fabric of nature at large. There are no hard borders that separate the four elements of your body with the four elements or five elements of the rest of the universe. So understand this little microcosm, and the implications may flow in all directions, big time. Right? So, as we now attend to the body, and we observe these emergences arising, the emergence of earth, water, fire, air, and so forth, we observe colors arising and shapes as we bring in the whole show, all five sensory fields. We'll get to the mind later. Right now, it's just physical. As we attend to the visual, we attend to the auditory. If you pick up anything, smells and tastes, and then certainly the tactile. Then we hold this thought in mind, these basic working hypotheses of causality. And then we can not only observe with bare attention, but we can bring our intelligence. This is where he uses the word contemplate, and don't just apply bare attention. The sounds that you hear, the colors that you see, what are the factors of origination? That's an effect. That's an effect. The colors and so forth, the tastes, the smells, the tactile sensations you experience, these are effects that are arising independent upon causes and conditions. Is it or is it not true? Again, none of this is dogma. And you don't get any prizes just by believing everything I'm saying. That doesn't liberate anything. That just gives you more like heaviness in your head. I got a little bit more knowledge. I think it's on the right side of my head. That's baggage. Right? But a view is a way of actually transforming the way you engage with reality. That could actually have some practical benefit. So is it true? Is it true that these effects that we are directly perceiving, which are real, colors, shapes, sounds, tactile sensations, and so forth, earth, water, fire, air, on all of these, as we immediately experience them, is it true that they are arising from a substantial cause, and if so, what's that? And what are the cooperative conditions? If a substantial cause by itself is never enough, if it needs cooperative conditions to catalyze, to manifest, to make it come forth, like the sprout from the seed, what are the cooperative conditions? So, bringing some real intelligence and bringing mindfulness now in the sense of bearing in mind what are the factors of origination, independence upon what? And this is where Buddhist analysis really goes, and we see it's there when the Buddha discusses the 18 dhatus, the 18 elements, or hard to find a really good translation, the 18 elements, the 18 domains of experience. Quite interesting, right? We have the six sense fields, okay, the visual field, auditory, and so forth, but the mental field as well, which is called dharma dhatu on a relative level. The dhatu, the domain of dharmas, mental phenomena, right, as well as the visual, auditory. We have six of those. And then, of course, we have six modes of consciousness, visual, auditory, right on through mental consciousness. Now we have 12. And then we have the faculties independent upon which these various modes of consciousness arise. In other words, we don't have an empty head here. We don't just have a lot of sound waves and photons and so forth coming in from the environment and an empty head and then just consciousness coming out. But there's something in here. Now, clearly, Buddhist physiology 2,500 years ago, which is first-person physiology after all, is going to be clearly different than the very sophisticated, marvelous knowledge we have, thanks to neuroscience, of the visual cortex, the auditory cortices, the olfactory lobes and so forth, different parts of the brain independent upon which visual perception, auditory, olfactory, and so forth arise. Right? One point before we jump in, and this is just kind of a sneak preview for later, that is, when it comes to the faculties, the indriya, the faculties independent upon which consciousness itself arises, the indriya, or faculties, sense faculties, independent upon which the five sensory modalities of consciousness arise, are all physical. They're all physical. Okay, so that would be, in principle, very much in accordance with modern neuroscience. Right, and therefore also, and both would agree, and I don't mean to suggest that they're simply the same, they're not, but in principle, if we leave it on this level, yeah, we're in agreement. So in principle, here in the Buddhist tradition, if you say, if you damage your visual faculty, you're going to lose your sight. Right? Damage your auditory faculty, you will not hear any longer. Right? That auditory faculty is physical, damage that, auditory consciousness won't arise anymore, or it will be altered, it will be, you know, damaged in one way. You'll start having hallucinations or what have you. And so the Buddhist principle here, though, is that the sense faculties of the five sense fields are all physical. Damage them, alter them, and the consciousness that arises independence upon them will be modified or eliminated. Right? What's the sense faculty? What's the faculty for the arising of mental consciousness? It's not physical. It's not physical. It's not the frontal cortex, it's not the hippocampus, it's not any part of the body, it's not your heart chakra. It's not physical at all. It's not material, but it's not physical either. It's just not physical at all. That faculty independence upon which mental consciousness arises. So if that's true, then the modern search led by Christoph Koch, where I find actually has a background in engineering and then in biology and then in cognitive neuroscience. He spent now decades. I spent a whole day with him a couple of years ago in dialogue with him and his colleagues, his students, fellow faculty. And he's really devoted his professional life now with his own Koch laboratories at Caltech to seeking out and identifying what are called the neural correlates of consciousness, the NCC. And the neural correlates of consciousness, as defined, are the minimal amount of neuronal activity required for the generation of consciousness. Right? So there's clearly many parts of the brain that are not necessary. So you can damage your visual cortex, you can't see anymore. That doesn't mean you become unconscious. You can damage another part and another part. You lose your memory. Then you lose your intelligence. And then you don't have the same emotions. And you damage more and more and more, but you can still be somewhat conscious. Right? Maybe not that interesting. And so just by that process of elimination, they're saying you can damage this, damage, but how much do you need to damage do you get to the point where you say, hey, it's about now as consciousness as a cell phone? Zero. So what's the minimal amount? And they're assuming, of course, because almost all of them, without exception, are materialists, they're almost all assuming that consciousness emerges from the brain or is equivalent to some neuronal activity in the brain or is a function of some neuronal activity in the brain. One of those three options. I mean, those are really, within the church of modern science, those are kind of the only three hypotheses that you're allowed to even present. If you ask anything else, they say, I'm sorry, that is heretical, and you may not say that. Be quiet. We don't allow that kind of talk here. We will call you a Cartesian, which means go to hell. Or at least get the hell out of here. And this is the great limitation. This is where the blinders of the scientific imagination come down, that either you're a materialist or you're a Cartesian dualist, which means either you're moderately smart or you're just flat out stupid. And there's no third alternative. Well, Buddhism said, we have another idea. Right? So the Buddhist answer is there are no NCC, so that is a fool's errand. It's a smart fool's errand. It's not a silly idea, but it's an idea for which you'll never get a satisfactory answer. And they haven't yet. Because there is no minimal amount of neuronal activity that is necessary for generating consciousness, because you can be brain dead and still have consciousness. You can be dead dead and have consciousness. It's called the bardo. Right? So there is no minimal amount. Which means that your psyche, your mental consciousness that you experience, is emerging from something. And of course it has cooperative conditions. The cooperative conditions are found inside the head. As your mental consciousness is arising from moment to moment with flavored in so many different ways, with emotions, desires, clarity, with dullness, with agitation, with sanity, with insanity, and so forth, your mental consciousness gets tremendously configured by brain chemistry, by genetics, the environment, food, drugs, alcohol, and so forth and so on. But they're all cooperative conditions. But where's your consciousness emerging from? What's the substantial cause that actually transforms into your consciousness? Well, not your brain. Otherwise, the older you got, the lighter your brain would become. Because your brain, which is made out of matter, would be transforming into something that's immaterial, and you become more and more lightheaded as you got older. Which nobody believes. Right? Is it true that consciousness actually emerges from nothing? You get a whole bunch of neuronal activity together as cooperative conditions, and they actually transform nothing into something. That would be very magical. Buddhism said, yeah, it's magical, it doesn't exist. Brain activity does act as cooperative conditions for the emergence of consciousness from moment to moment, conditions, configures, modifies, has tremendous impact on mental consciousness. But mental consciousness does not and never has emerged from matter, not in the matter inside the head or anywhere else. And when if one studies physics and chemistry, if you just study physics and chemistry and say, oh, by the way, those atoms you've been studying, they actually give rise to emotions. Where the hell did you come up with that idea? That is so out. Why do you think that? I mean, that is just so bizarre. Because in the whole understanding of the natural world, there are emergent properties all over the place. That notion of emergence just saturates the whole universe. You have phenomena, and then you have the compilation of a lot of aggregates coming together, and then emergent properties coming out of large configurations of neurons, of stars. Galaxies do things that individual stars don't do. Stars do things that individual hydrogen atoms don't do, and so forth and so on. Emergent properties are everywhere throughout nature. But here's also something that's true everywhere throughout nature. The emergent properties of physical phenomena are physical. That's true everywhere in the universe. The emergent properties of physical phenomena are themselves physical, which means they lend themselves to physical measurement. Mental phenomena do not lend themselves to physical measurement. They're all invisible. So that should really end the debate right there. But it doesn't, of course. So here we are. We come back to our experience of being in the physical world and the close application of mindfulness to our immediate impressions, the appearances that arise, that are the very constituents of this Lebenswelt, of this lived world, of being in the physical world, and we can ask, where do they come from? Where are they emerging from? What are the factors of origination, factors of disillusion? Okay. So that was a mouthful. That was about 26 minutes. 27. So let's go back now. That's theory. But theory not in just something to think about and talk about and refute or agree with. Because if you refute it, okay, that's fine. But then you've just stopped the conversation. And if you simply agree with it, that's fine. And you've just stopped the conversation. In which case, what was the point? Just have more stuff to think about? You already had plenty to think about. You didn't need me. But if you take some of these ideas and say, this is interesting, let's take this into experience and probe closely and start examining closely our experience of our experience of the physical world and attending closely to, and here's Buddhist, this is a very important point, Buddhist notion of causality. And this is right to Sautrantika. We're still talking about classical Buddhist philosophy, Sautrantika. It's simply independence upon this, that arose. Independence upon that, this arose. With this being absent, that no longer arose. With this being absent, this no longer arose. It's purely phenomenological. Purely phenomenological. Right? The notion of mechanism, that in order for causality to happen, that two things have to bump into each other. Good old Newtonian mechanics of billiard balls going, being like that. That's all very well for billiard balls. But it doesn't work well when you interface electromagnetism with mechanics, Newtonian mechanics. It doesn't work well at all. Electromagnetic fields are not billiard balls. So there is no mechanical explanation for the interface between electromagnetic fields and atoms. There is an explanation. It's intelligible, but it's not mechanical. So this is unfortunately seems to be lost on most people working in the mind sciences, because they keep on talking about the underlying neural mechanisms of subjective experience. And then they insist that the subjective experience must itself be brain mechanism, because otherwise how could the brain ever influence the mind if the mind is something other than the brain? And then they just stop thinking. And if they'd look into the fact that, in fact, in physics, something interesting happened in the 20th century, and maybe even in the 21st century, they would see that notion of causality, the only way that events can take place in the brain is if something bumps into them, that notion went out with a horse and buggy in the late 19th century. No serious physicist believes that's the only type of causality any longer. There's quantum mechanics, relativity theory, and so forth. It's totally passé. But we still encounter this. We encounter it in Hamburg, remember? With that woman, that very sharp woman, neuroscience. And I asked her if they had some really clear empirical evidence to refute your materialistic assumptions. Would you, like the Dalai Lama, throw out your beliefs in the face of compelling empirical evidence? Her answer was very equivocal. But then she said, I'm a neuroscientist. I believe the mind is the brain. That's pretty much a direct quote. You remember it, yeah? I'm a neuroscientist. I believe the mind is the brain. And then I don't remember the exact dialogue, but I said, yeah. Why? Why do you believe that? I mean, your mind and your brain are so different. It's like looking at Natu and then looking at Danny and say, you know, they're really the same person. I know they don't look alike, but in fact, they really have very few qualities. I mean, he's over there and she's over there. But never mind, they really have to be the same person. And why? And she said, because I cannot imagine how there could be mind-body or mind-brain interactions if the mind were anything other than the brain. And since you can't imagine it, case closed. Which is, I think, really, I don't mean to pick on one person because she's representing a whole field, so I'd rather pick on the whole field. Severe imagination deficit disorder. Because it's so obviously, manifestly, flamboyantly false. I mean, it's not really even debatable. It's really not even debatable. There's just this one point, and then it will go back to meditation. We're living, you've ever heard the phrase that we're living in the information era? You ever heard that one? Information age? We should start taking that seriously. Because information, physicists know it, neuroscientists know it, psychologists know it, philosophers know it. Information does exist. Information, what do you think? What do you think, Chetra? Does information have causal efficacy? Yeah. You know how I know? It's because I just asked you a question and you nodded your head. That is, it wasn't the sound waves coming from my mouth that made your head go up and down. Chetra, listen up really carefully now. She didn't nod in agreement. She just started laughing at me. Right? So what, and does information have causal efficacy? The sound waves are pretty much the same. A little bit of hot air coming from my mouth as usual. But in one case, there was information. In the other case, it was just hot air with some noise coming together with it. But it was, what do you think? Does information have causal efficacy? She smiled and she nodded. And so that was a moving of facial muscles and moving of head. In response to, catalyzed by what? Information, a question, not the physical medium, the sound waves. The sound waves are physically, yeah, but that didn't cause her to nod her head. It was the information, and information is not physical. Information has no physical attributes whatsoever, no mass, no location, no momentum, no weight, no charge, no, not a single physical attribute. It's not physical. It's not material or physical. It certainly has causal efficacy. And my asking the question, do you think information has causal efficacy, without a shadow of a doubt, catalyzed, serving as a cooperative condition, catalyzed certain brain events in her brain, which then they catalyzed more brain events, which then caused her head to go up and down, as well as, of course, thinking going on and coming to a conclusion, yes, information has causal efficacy. But there it is. Is that not sufficient? Information has no physical attributes whatsoever, and it clearly has causal efficacy. It influenced her brain, it influenced her behavior influenced my behavior, and so forth and so on. Information is there to stay. It's not physical, and it has causal efficacy. It has impact on the brain, as the brain has impact on information as well. So information is part of the natural world. So, hola. So now finally, we go to the practice. We're going to go right back to close application of mindfulness, but with discerning intelligence, being willing to reflect, to contemplate when it seems appropriate, through bare attention, getting the raw data, getting good measurements, and then reflecting on the substantial causes and the cooperative conditions giving rise to your immediate experience of the physical world, with your body being in the center of the universe. And of course it is. Your body is in the center of your universe. Right? Not everybody else's, just yours. So there we are. So let's go in. I'll give just a little bit of guided instruction for the practice. But no real new methodology, but just now more enriched with ways of viewing that with which we are familiar. But first of all, we reboot. We settle down. Let your awareness slip out of the conceptual mode, the ruminating mode, come right down to the ground. Non-conceptually settle your body in its natural state, your breathing in its natural rhythm. For just a brief time, simplify your mind, releasing concepts about the future and the past, even about the present. Come and let your awareness rest in its own place, quiet, still, clear, in the present moment. Then let the light of your awareness flood the space of your body with discerning intelligence, mindful presence. we've already attended to the first of three fundamental marks of existence. And that is the ubiquitous nature of impermanence of all conditioned phenomena, arising and passing from moment to moment. We've taken note of that. And now within this field, this fathom-long body, within this field of tactile sensations, let's turn our attention to the second of those three marks. It's called by one term dukkha. We're not looking here for suffering, but rather as you attend to the appearances arising within this tactile field, when you note either pleasure or pain, comfort or discomfort, closely apply mindfulness. And see whether any of these tactile appearances are themselves, by nature, objectively, pleasant or unpleasant. We will apply this in between sessions as well. When we eat tasty food, we see a lovely sunset, we hear pleasant sounds and so forth, we will ask in between sessions, is the pleasure actually coming from the object? Is it by nature a true source of sukha, of joy, of pleasure? Is it by nature a true source of dukkha, of suffering, dissatisfaction, displeasure? Within the field of the body, examine the very nature of the events you're perceiving. To see whether any of them by nature are intrinsically pleasurable or unpleasurable. And now open up all five doors of sensory perception, that is, of the five physical senses. Let the light of your awareness illuminate all of these five domains. Let your way of viewing these five domains of experience be enriched with a question. Is there anything here that is static, unchanging, mutable? We're not asking, for example, whether the molecules in the tiles of the floor are permanent or impermanent. That's very subtle. Perhaps too subtle for us to observe right now. It's up to the physicist to tell us. But that's not the question. The question is in the visual appearances. The colors and shapes arising. You see anything static? Hear anything static? Smell, taste, touch, anything unchanging? And if you experience anything among these five sensory fields as being pleasant or unpleasant, examine closely. Are those qualities right in the very nature of the phenomena themselves, in the appearances? Are they there objectively? Are they the true sources of the pleasure or displeasure that you experience? And now let's come back to a simpler question from before. And that is, in terms of the phenomena that actually appear to your visual perception, the phenomena that arise in the auditory field, the tactile field, is there any overlap among the phenomena arising in these three domains? Which is to say, is there anything that does actually appear within the visual that also appears in the auditory or tactile, or vice versa? Or are these non-overlapping domains of appearances? It's a simple question. For just a little time, let your awareness be totally still, illuminating all the five sense fields, but without going out to any of them or grasping onto anything, simply illuminating the appearances. Ho'olasso. I'd like to come back briefly to the first two of the three marks of existence. And related to a theme that runs through all of modern science, but very briefly, that is the notion of revolution. Revolution. Right? So until Copernicus, until Galileo, widely believed, the Earth is in the center of the whole universe. The universe is about 7,000 years old, that is within Eurocentric view, Christian, Judeo-Christian view. We're in the center. All of those are pretty much ornaments. Thank you, God. It's a very pretty night sky. And that was it. And speaking with no joke, I mean, this was Newton's view. This was Galileo's view. That is, not the Earth in the center, but, you know. And then, with Copernicus coming up with mathematically and Galileo giving some empirical confirmation, then the Earth is no longer the center. It's just one of the various planets going around the sun. Now the sun seems to be in the center. But nevertheless, we got displaced from the center. And so that doesn't really revolutionize a way of life, but in terms of your understanding of the place of our world in the whole universe, once you get that, you simply cannot look at the universe in the same way any longer. It's just different. We're not at the center. That's a big deal. It's a really, really big deal. If you don't understand it, then, okay, you're pre-revolutionary. But if you do understand it, then you simply cannot look at the night sky or the place of our planet in the universe in the same way anymore. Your way of viewing reality is fundamentally shifted. Right? There was the first revolution in modern science. It was in astronomy. The first revolution, the only revolution we've had, or at least beginning of the revolution in life sciences, was Darwin. Again, prior to Darwin, widely believed that species are static. Even at the time of Darwin, there were still people that thought, not the very educated ones, that the universe is 7,000 years old. Geology was proving that to be false, but it was tough to let go of. Those taking a literal interpretation of the Bible. But the notion of species being static was there. It was really right there until the mid-19th century. Darwin, based upon about 25 years of very, very careful research, empirical research, shows that's not true. You know, and once you get it, once you really understood the empirical basis for his theory, and then Wallace was the cohort, he also did his research, not me, the other one. Alfred Russel Wallace. Co-discoverer, did his own research, marvelous research, both of them. But Darwin's was more thorough, it was richer, more sophisticated, more elaborated, so he really deserves to get the primary credit. But once you've understood that, then you simply cannot view life on this planet or human existence, our own biological presence here, in the same way. You just can't go back to pre-Darwin. So the way of viewing life on the planet, it's a revolution. You simply cannot view it in the same way any longer. And then in physics, now just to be really quickly, quantum mechanics and relativity theory. Anybody who really followed that, you simply cannot view space, time, matter, and energy in the same way. If you've understood it, you cannot go back to 19th century physics. There are assumptions there that are just false, and you have to view reality in a new way. Second revolution in the physical sciences. All right, but that's what revolution means. It's not just an adding of ideas or a new bright idea or a fresh discovery. It's that the whole axis is shifted right down to the core. Some fundamental assumptions you do not hold any longer. Earth being in the center, species are static. We're all by ourselves. Human beings are totally different from all the animals, you know. And likewise, absolute space, time, matter, energy. They're gone. They're gone as the dodo. They're extinct. You cannot believe that if you know physics. You can if you don't know physics, but that means you're just, you know, not up to date. If one really not only believes, that's not a big deal. But if one really fathoms so that it gets onto the bone marrow of the way you view reality, right into the stream, the flow of the way you're viewing reality, if you really get this simple statement, all conditioned phenomena are impermanent. If that's not just a belief, if that gets right into your view, it's saturating your view, your way of viewing reality, coarse impermanence, subtle impermanence. You cannot view reality in the same way any longer. And that is, even though we do project our evaluations, our judgments, our categories, our labels, and so forth, I'll love you forever, this relationship will be forever, oh, now finally I've got something I can really hold on to, now I'm really a whole, oh, I'm so glad I'm healthy, I'm locking onto all these things, you know. All these superimpositions, relatively static. people thinking they're attractive. Don't hold your breath. You're losing it right now as you speak. You know? I mean, if you're not yet 20, okay, there's a little bit of good time left, but after 20, bye-bye. The image, the idea is static. I'm attractive, I'm intelligent, I'm this, I'm that. Other people, my relationship, this, this, this. That which we superimpose, relatively static. But when you actually fathom the reality of impermanence, you see, that's just fluff. That's camouflage. And the reality is everything is just fizzing. One of the meditations done in the Theravada tradition, I've never seen it in the Mahayana, comes in Buddhaghosa's Path of Purification. It's really powerful. It's way up there in the Vipassana section. It's for people who are really, really professional yogis. I mean, they've nailed their shamatha, probably gotten some of the jhanas, and they're deep into Vipassana territory. And they got this extremely like high frequency, really high definition samadhi. And they select, they do something, they're very selective. They're observing impermanence, right? Within impermanence, there's a rising and passing, moment to moment, moment to moment, right? Standard Buddhism. What do they do empirically is they come into a very narrow bandwidth and they focus their attention like a brain surgeon going down and just, you know, doing something incredibly precise. They focus just on the factor of disillusion. Whatever they're attending to, they just focus like a laser view, just looking at that, just the process of disillusion, just the falling away. And they go into samadhi on that. Of just the falling away, falling away. See, that just blasts any attachment you have to anything. Because you just see it all vanishing. Whether it's your body, your loved one, your reputation, your wealth, your home, your planet, your guru, whatever it is, you're just seeing, it's like going to a train station and seeing the train pulling out of the station. How attached can you get to that train? You're not going to catch it. Gone. And that's the whole of reality is bye-bye. So long, farewell. Dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee. I'm gone. And that's everything. Now, of course, you can focus on origination too, but when they want to develop really intense, radically revolutionary renunciation, they'll focus on dissolution. It just blows the crap out of attachment. Just dissolve it. There's just nothing. You're just like trying to grasp onto a waterfall. You just see there's nothing to grasp onto. So you radical disillusionment. I mean existential disillusionment of thinking that you can attend to anything that appears and thinking, oh, that's going to deliver happiness. The train's leaving the station. It's not going to deliver anything. It's going. It's gone, right? Very powerful. That's revolutionary, to really realize the subtle and the coarse impermanence of all phenomena. That changes everything. Because here we are, we have this prime directive as sentient beings, avoid suffering, find happiness. And we open eyes and say, oh, what's going to make me happy? First thing is mama, pretty much, right? Mama. And what she's got up here, upstairs, that's where happiness comes from. I think baby's got that one figured out, right? And then we go from there, and, you know, men never get over that. I'm sorry for that. Still looking for it, you know. But even if it's not that, we're still looking for the substitute, okay, after that, after breast milk, after that, what's going to give it to you? So the attention tends to be focused there. And thinking with this ever, ever arising fresh hope, that marriage didn't work out, but I bet this one will. I didn't like living there, but I'm sure this will work out better. That job sucked, but this one's going to be good. You know, wake up, smell the roses, they're fading. And then you can either go into total meltdown of abysmal, existential, mind-crunching depression, or you can see maybe there's another way you can find happiness that isn't by grasping onto objects and appearances. And if that doesn't work out, then you're really toast. You either got Dharma or you're really down the sewer. I mean, really, there's no hope. So, but that's it. That's what Dharma is for. That's when people come really authentic in their Dharma practice. That's when they get irreversibly into the stream of Dharma practice. When they say there's nothing else that has even a smidgen of hope, none, to really provide satisfaction, genuine happiness. Nothing else has any chance, so therefore, even if it's only one chance in a million for Dharma, go for it. It's the best bet. Because everything else is zero out of a million. One out of a million, I'll take that over zero out of a million. Right. And if you have a Buddha nature, the odds are looking even better. So that's the first one. Dujja tamse mitakpa, all composite phenomena, all phenomena that arise independent upon, causes and conditions that are formed, configured, they're all impermanent. And then we have this one, which is the theme for today, because we're moving right through these pretty quickly. But we'll keep on returning to these three marks of existence, because they are absolutely revolutionary. Not just to believe in, then it's just more baggage. But if you actually let this into your way of viewing reality, they just change everything. And the second one, which is when you dumb it down to Neolithic brain damage, you call it life is suffering. Well, please throw that one out, because that's just too stupid to talk about. I don't know, it keeps on cropping up. I just want to get a sledgehammer. I just smash it whenever I see it. The phrase in Tibetan is Dzogchen Tamjit Dungal Wa. Dzogchen Tamjit Dungal Wa. Dzogchen means contaminated, tainted, defiled. So that's just an adjective. Dzogchen, that which is defiled. Dungal Wa means unsatisfying. Unsatisfying. It doesn't mean suffering. Like, you know, getting a knife poked into your cheek. That's suffering. That's pain. That's not this word. Dungalwa is not just pain. It's dungalwa, it's a subtle distinction. It's unsatisfying. So what's defiled? Any experience, here it is, vast, vast statement. Any experience that is configured by, defiled, contaminated, tainted by mental afflictions. You can just take three for starters. Delusion, craving, hostility. Anything, any experience of anything, your own mind, your body, your lover, your children, your parents, your home, possessions, your reputation, anything whatsoever. Sunsets, nature, galaxies, anything you experience. Any experience whatsoever that is configured by, tainted, caught up in the network of mental afflictions will be unsatisfying. You may look upon it and say, oh, this place really makes me happy. I've always wanted to live in nature because living in nature just makes me happy. That lake and those trees and the mountains, I just love living in nature because it just makes me happy. As if it's kind of just oozing little pods of puffs of joy coming out of the water, out of the trees and the clouds. And some, you know, as if nature is actually making you happy. You know, oh, I love nature. It makes me happy. Or I love you. You make me so happy. Thank you for that. I'm just getting the happy vibes from you. I'm so happy you make me happy. Because you're the source of my happiness. I can't live without you. Because if I didn't have you, I wouldn't be happy at all. So keep it flowing. People talk that way. Not quite that silly, but that's what they say. You make me so happy. And then, of course, you make me miserable. You just make me miserable. Quit doing that. Quit spraying me with misery. I can't stand it. You make me so unhappy. I just see you and I get unhappy. Don't talk. Your voice makes me unhappy. I don't want to see your face. I don't even see your toenails. I just see your toenails. It makes me unhappy. I don't hear your name. I hear your name. It makes me unhappy. Just, you know, Fred. Oh, Fred, I can't. Really get into that. Can't stand, you know, Delhi. Just Delhi is such an unhappy place. Ever been to Delhi? Have you ever seen the sun in Delhi? I haven't in a long, long time. Doesn't matter what time of the day. Have you ever been to Beijing? Have you ever seen the sun in Beijing? I have been to Beijing. I've never seen the sun. I don't even know where it is. And Delhi's the same. 3 o'clock, 9 o'clock in the morning, noon, you never know what the sun is. It's just so much crap in the air, you can't see anything except for the crap in the air. Boy, these places are really, they'll make you miserable. Beijing, Delhi, the list could go on. You know, they're just unhappy places. Whereas Santa Barbara. Santa Barbara's a happy place. In fact, they did a whole soap opera that I first saw in Beijing. And it's quite obvious Santa Barbara's just a happy place because, number one, everybody's gorgeous. You see the soap opera, man, they're all young, or if they're old, they age really, really well. They never go to the bathroom. They never need to bathe. And they all have such interesting lives. That's Santa Barbara. It's a happy place. But the happiest place in the world is called Disneyland. They said so. You know, it's actually the happiest place in the world. Because you go there and you just become happy, because it makes you happy. So that notion, you know, that is actually emerging from the side of objects, from appearances, it's all over the advertising industry. It sells, and is utterly delusional. So Dzogchen Tamchen Dungal Wa, it's really like, oh, caramba. If that's true, that changes everything. That is, no matter where I go, to Santa Barbara, to Disneyland, to Beijing, no matter what, whatever I experience, whatever I acquire, whoever I meet, wherever I go, it's never going to really deliver the happiness that I seek. And when it says Dungal Wa, it means that you may focus on something, someone, something intangible, like a gold medal in the Olympics, or fame, or reputation, or power, or acquisition of this, that, and the other thing, or a relationship. And you may think, but this really does make me happy. This person really does make me happy. It's all very well you're making light of this, Alan, but this person actually does make me happy. We can actually believe that. And is it true that when we're with this person, a lot of happiness arises? Yes. But the Buddhist premise here is, if something is truly the source of your happiness, this means that whenever the person, some physical object, a place, if it's truly the source of your happiness, then it should be like an artesian well of happiness. An artesian well always gives rise to water. Whenever you go to it, you get more water. Spend 10 hours by it, you get 10 hours of water coming out. That's an artesian well. That's a true source of water. If another person, place, reputation, tangible, intangible, whatever, is a true source of happiness, then the longer you stay with that person, the happier you should become. If this cell phone, which used to be a really new one, if this really made me happy, I should just be able to hold it in my hand and just feel the happiness flowing. And just, I can just sit there and, yep, it just makes me happy indefinitely. If that's a true source of happiness, it should just kind of keep on flowing. Just make me happy, 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 happy indefinitely. Is there anything you really want to do indefinitely? Hour after hour after hour that you would expect would still make you happy? Think of your favorite thing, and now think about doing that for 12 hours straight. Is there a point when it's not quite so pleasant? And is there a point at which you'd just be screaming your head off, please make it stop? So that's unsatisfying. It's not to say that there's no such thing as a satisfactory marriage. Of course there are. Or friendships. Relationship with teachers, with jobs, very satisfying jobs, for sure. I love my work. I find it very satisfying. Do I want to teach all day? Not a true source of happiness. Uh-uh. And so that's Dungal Wa. Any experience we have that is tainted by mental afflictions, it's Dungal Wa. It's unsatisfying. It's not a true source of happiness. It's not the genuine article. And so once again, the easy response would be, oh, then everything sucks. And then just become, you know, miserable, depressed. Or you might say, all right, if all experiences that are contaminated by mental afflictions are unsatisfying, how about taking the mental afflictions out? And then what are the experiences? And then it does not say that all things are suffering. If your experience of other people, the environment, your body, and so forth, is not contaminated by mental afflictions, then the unsatisfying quality vanishes. In other words, it's not there in reality. It's not planet Earth sucks, or Beijing, or Delhi, or Santa Barbara. It's none of these places intrinsically suck. or intrinsically are sources of misery. They're not. It's the way we experience them. And insofar as, and it is a gradient, insofar as our experience of anything whatsoever is contaminated by mental afflictions, it will suck. It's only a matter of sooner or later. But it will be unsatisfying. So then you say, well, but that would imply there's really only one thing to do. Purify your mind. And then everything can be satisfying. And don't purify your mind, and you can be as wealthy as Carlos Slim and still be as unhappy as he is. Have you ever seen his face? Not a happy camper. I've seen him interviewed. I'm the richest man in the world. I own 60 companies. $60 billion and counting. So what? So what? So that's the second one. If one simply believes that no big impact, but if that gets into the way you're viewing reality, then it touches everything. There's nothing that's left untouched. And it doesn't mean you become disillusioned with your spouses, your family, your job, your place of living, and so forth. That's not the implication at all. It is to say that if you'd like to find greater satisfaction, greater joy, greater happiness, and meaning and fulfillment, it's not by going from here to there to there to there. It's by purifying your experience of everything. And that's really the only solution. So there it is. Whatever the question is, Dharma is the only answer. Yeah, that's it. All right. So practical things. I'm running on a bit. But now it's just totally practical. We have just a few minutes. But it's kind of cool stuff, isn't it? Because that's what this is about. It's not to learn a dogma or a doctrine to get all your beliefs right. It's to radically transform the way you view reality such that your whole experience of existence becomes more and more satisfying. And in the same breath, more realistic. The truth shall make you free. Can you elaborate on the meaning of non-conceptual and conceptual thoughts? I don't usually speak of, in fact, I never speak of non-conceptual thoughts. Say again?
Yeah, no, I realized that the word thoughts is
like that. I couldn't understand, sorry.
I didn't mean provide thoughts.
Okay, so non-conceptual thought. It's so just experience. Non-conceptual and conceptual experience. Very good. It is a subtle issue, and that could easily take up our whole 8 minutes. It's a very good question. It's a subtle question, too. And that is, number one, I'll speak right from the Mahayana perspective. Do we have the option, can we simply decide to have a truly, utterly non-conceptual experience of anything? Can we decide? Okay, I've had it, no more concept. The answer is no. It's not within voluntary control. Even when you achieve shamatha, and through extensive, rigorous training in shamatha, your whole coarse mind dissolves into the substrate consciousness. That's a pretty big deal. Is it non-conceptual? On a coarse level, yes. Subtle level, no. It's not non-conceptual. Craving still arises. Attachment can still arise to the bliss, the luminosity, and non-conceptuality of the substrate consciousness. And mental afflictions are always carried on the backs of conceptual mind. Very subtle, but still there. So Mahayana view, even in deep sleep, it's subliminally conceptual, right? So Mahayana view, it's only when you have a direct realization of emptiness, non-conceptual. That is totally, absolutely non-conceptual. Now, interesting point here from Genlam Rinpa. He's one of the most formidable yogis I've ever met. I had the opportunity to live with him for a whole year in the same cabin. And he was really a very deep meditator on emptiness. Lamrim generally, but emptiness. He really meditated a lot. He was deep. And he died quite spectacularly, wandered into the clear light of death, remained there for 5 days. So there was nothing phony about him. There's just nothing phony about him. Absolutely authentic. And he said, you know, when you go into meditation and emptiness, and the conceptual mind goes totally silent, I mean it goes right down to zero, the whole phenomenal world vanishes. Not because you've withdrawn. That happens just by samadhi. You draw your awareness, you go into the substrate, the whole world's vanished from your perspective. But it's still conceptual a little bit. It's not that. It's not a matter of withdrawal at all. It's realizing the empty nature of all appearing phenomena and realizing that emptiness with a non-conceptual mind, the phenomena themselves vanish. The whole entire phenomenal world vanishes. And so you see empirically the truth of the statement that all phenomena arise independent upon conceptual designation. And if the conceptual designation ceases totally, all phenomena just vanish. That's a big deal. Of course, when you reactivate the conceptual mind, they appear again. So that's deeply non-conceptual. Now, in terms of modern cognitive psychology, and because of the Mind and Life conferences that I participated in, I think the general view, and it's a very smart view, is that, but they're speaking within the bandwidth of normal minds, basically this, brain damage, mentally ill, and normal. That's almost entirely the whole bandwidth that all of modern cognitive psychology deals with hardly any exceptions. Brain damage, mentally ill, and normal. Everything above that is invisible. Okay? In other words, the most important part is totally invisible, which therefore doesn't factor in. Because why would they? It's outside their database. So, fair enough. The view, and this I learned from the world-famous cognitive psychologist at Princeton, Anne Treisman. She says, all of our experience is saturated by concepts. All of our experience. That is, just open your eyes. And the conceptual configuration of phenomena into objects and so forth, it's just saturated, it's right there. You can't stop it. So they do not make a distinction. And I think she speaks for a lot of people in her field, very, very smart, of course. But that our experience just generally is saturated by conceptual constructs. Okay? So, a lot of truth to that. A lot of truth to that. So, but then we can ask the gradient. Just like with free will, I'm not going to try to answer that right now, but just broadly, if you're drunk and somebody has also just put, you know, 3 tabs of psilocybin into your drink, and you're drunk, and you get into the car, can you exercise free will to drive safely? You don't have a chance. You cannot exercise free will. You may say, I want to drive very responsibly here. Lots of luck. You have 0 chance of driving responsibly because your brain is damaged by the drugs. Right? How about if you're psychotic, you're schizophrenic? How much free will do you have? Very little. Very little. So let's take these cases. A person who's brain damaged, doped, drunk, schizophrenic, and all the way then to a Buddha. It's a smooth spectrum. The further you are along the spectrum to being liberated, an arhat, awake as a Buddha, the further along that spectrum, the freer you are. And the more damaged, schizophrenic, psychotic, and so forth, the less free you are. In other words, it's the Buddha's never even raises the question, do we have it or do we not? Just where are you in the spectrum? And not only where are you in the spectrum, but where are you today? Where are you this morning, this afternoon? Because we vary. You know. So, as we find that, it turns into a very pragmatic question. And the question is not, what can I do to achieve free will, but rather, how can I be freer? Because when, let alone being psychotic, if I just get so pissed off that my mind just gets caught up in rage, how free am I to fall asleep? How free am I to enjoy a good joke or a pleasant meal? Or to even attend to the person I'm pissed off at in a reasonable, clear, unbiased way? I don't have any freedom at all. So that goes for craving, it goes for delusion, it goes for anger, jealousy, and so forth and so on. The more your mind is dominated by mental afflictions, the less free you are. And therefore, comes back to the same theme. Sound like a broken record, doesn't it? Free your mind of mental afflictions, you become freer and freer and freer in every matter, in every way that actually is meaningful. So, in a similar fashion, to be conceptual or not conceptual, well, just for starters, wouldn't it be cool to not be always inundated by the flow of rumination? Because rumination is really coarse junk, like junk food of the mind. That's conceptual. But you've had moments, 5 seconds here, 10 seconds there, when like, wow, that was refreshing. I had a period of no rumination. I was just being clear and present. So that would be relatively non-conceptual. And then we go from coarse excitation, medium excitation, subtle excitation. So we see it's a whole bandwidth there, a whole spectrum of less and less conceptual, and then picking up thoughts and using them intelligently. How do they relate to discursive thoughts and language? Well, it is well known. Again, I can draw off. It's already 6 o'clock. Sorry. But I'll get to these tomorrow. But I wanted to download these really important issues, impermanence and the whole issue of causality and the issues of dukkha. What was the point here? And that was... oh, yeah. Nonverbal conceptualization. There's no question we have it. Animals have it. Don't know a whole lot about what it feels like to be an animal, except for on our bad days. But there's There's very good empirical evidence, scientific evidence, that babies inside the womb during the last trimester, last 3 months, can distinguish between the sound of their mother's voice and somebody else's voice, another woman. Good neurophysiological evidence for that. Right? Now, shall we assume that the unborn baby hasn't learned any language yet? If we go along with that assumption, the baby is able to distinguish this from that. It may not, it doesn't say mama, but does recognize that, which means there's some conceptual process there that is labeling this versus that, right? Let alone pleasure and pain, and so forth. And then animals of a wide variety, they may or may not have language, but they certainly do conceive. Dogs can be jealous. Anybody who's owned a dog, you know they can be jealous. And they can be angry. And they can be craving and attached. And so forth and so on. So is a conceptual mind possible without language? The answer is yes. And we find this when we slip down beneath the veil of the rumination, which tends to be caught up a lot in language, and slip down to, how many fingers am I holding up again? And before the language comes in, you already know, right? So there are layers and layers, subtlety upon subtlety of discursive thought, going from the coarse mind to rumination, caught up totally in your own language, down to the more primitive level, softer level, subtler level in the substrate consciousness, all the way right down to the total silencing of discursive thought in the direct realization of emptiness. But overall, as we now end, core theme in this contemplative science, or this adhyatma vidya, this inner knowledge, inner science, is to be able to get as clear data as we can, to use the scientific terminology. And that is when we're having a conversation with someone, to be able to attend, to give somebody our whole attention. I'll quote again my dear friend, this Benedictine monk, Lawrence Freeman. Very dear friend of mine. We spoke conference just a few months back in London. And he made a statement when we were giving another workshop in Santa Barbara years ago. He said, the greatest gift you can give to another person is your attention. This means that you're giving them fully your attention. That is not that you're thinking, you're attending to them with your commentary and your judgments, and I hope you do this and I hope you don't do that, which is a little like, you know, sitting in a dust bowl. But actually going through the dust bowl and attending fully to the other person as that person is presenting him or herself to you as a subject, giving your whole attention, quietly, drinking them in. I drink you in with my eyes. That's often romantic talk. But how about setting aside the romance and just, I'm drinking you in as a human being. I'm giving you my heart, my ears, my mind, my eyes. I'm drinking you in. I'm as fully present with you as I possibly can be. And that's the greatest gift I can give you first. And after that, I might give you a meal, or money, or education, or whatever, something else you need. But first, I'll drink you in. First, I'll give you my most precious and non-refundable, non-renewable asset, and that is my attention. I can't get it back after I've given it to you. Those moments are gone. But I gave you what was most precious, and that's my time. And I gave it to you as purely as I could, not from what I can get from you as an investment, but what I can actually offer you, to offer you, to offer you, with no expectation or anticipation of kickback. And now what are you going to give me? No, just what can I offer you? That's a bodhisattva ideal, isn't it? Right? So with that then, clearly once again it's a gradient. But this means we're attending fully and receiving fully what the person has to offer, whether it's their grief, their anxiety, their joy, their frustration, their sadness, their satisfaction, whatever it may be. Drinking it in, getting clear. So this is what you have to offer today. And being receptive to it, and then responding. That's pretty sweet. That's very human, human to human. That's the way it should be. Likewise with animals, human to animal, sentient being to sentient being, sentient being to sentient being. There it is. Oh yeah. I'll get to these tomorrow. Now it's dinner time. Enjoy. And when you're enjoying your meal, just think what it would be like to eat that meal for 12 hours straight.